For the week of September 26th, 2010, this is Showbiz Sandbox, Episode 73, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Roussillon, France, je suis Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And manning a picket line in the Shire in Middle Earth, I'm Michael Giltz.
I have no idea what you're talking about, but I'm sure somewhere during the next 50 minutes you will tell us.
Absolutely.
Perfect. Well, actually, this week, I'm still on the road, as you can probably hear. I am in France, but I think I have a better internet connection this week than I did last week when I had less than 1 megabit per second. This week, we're going to discuss the theatrical release windows again. It turns out the FCC ruling we said would allow studios to release movies both theatrically and via video on demand at the same time is doing just that. We'll also talk about the future of Netflix now that Blockbuster has filed for bankruptcy, and with the start of the new television season, we'll give our expert opinion on which shows will be picked up for an entire season and which ones will be canceled. Of course, I use the word expert loosely because I have no idea what any of these shows are about.
Hey, we're experts.
I'm pointing towards myself in that regard. We also have some music news since the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame announced this year's inductees, and we even have a smattering of Broadway news. The only thing we don't have this week is a special guest because I'm traveling and I just thought it would be a little hard to arrange for a special guest with the scheduling conflicts and everything. Of course, we'll review the week's top entertainment headlines during Big Deal or Big Whoop, except for Lindsay Lohan because, frankly, we're just sick of telling you that she's going to jail and then being released early.
Yeah.
Exactly. First, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
And the number one movie at the box office this week is a sequel, Wall Street Money Never Sleeps. The sequel to Oliver Stone's 1987 film, which opened to $19 million, another hit film for Shia LaBeouf. At number two is Legend of the Guardians, The Owls of Ga'Hoole, which is an animated film from Australia based on a series of children's books that grossed $16 million. And number three is Ben Affleck's The Town, which grossed $15.6 million. It's at $48 million total for a movie that cost $37 million. It's getting good word of mouth and holding well, and looks like it's another substantial hit for him. And at number four is Easy A, a really well-reviewed high school comedy that I need to check out. That grossed $10.6 million, and it's at $32 million total, so that's a big hit for Screen Gems for a movie that only cost $8 million to make. And at number five, the real dog of the week is You Again, yet another attempt by Kristen Bell to make a good film. I don't know why such a talented person can't make one, but she has terrible taste in script. $8.4 million for the movie, it's dead on arrival. And number six, the M. Night Shyamalan film Devil, $6.6 million. And number seven, Resident Evil Afterlife. Then Alpha and Omega, a children's animated film that's coming and going in the blink of an eye. And number nine and ten are Takers and Inception. So, you know, a big week for Ben Affleck. I think it's really establishing him as a serious filmmaker.
Yeah, but I think you're being too hard on Kristen Bell.
I love her, but...
I love her, too, but it's not... Think of her place in the entertainment world. She's not A-list, so it's not like she's got her pick of scripts. She takes what she can get.
She keeps getting leading roles, though. People obviously believe in her.
That's why the movies that she's getting lead roles in are not fantastic, because she's not A-list.
Well, I hope she's successful in getting the Veronica Mars feature film off the ground, which she says she would even fund herself. I know. So, but yeah, it's very depressing because, you know, I really like her and want her to be good. And the movie, I just can't bring myself to see the film.
No, I'm not going to go see it either.
Did you see anything this weekend?
No, I was catching up on all my new TV shows so that I could be educated for our talk today.
Exactly. So was I.
Well, and you mentioned, Michael, The Town. It dropped only 34%, which is pretty good for an adult. It's basically an adult-oriented film. It's an adult drama. And I don't mean that in the adult sense, but in the, like, for grown-ups?
Well, actually, it's a little reverse. It's normally the kids' movies and the big blockbusters that drop harder. Adult films tend to have better legs, but it is doing well. It's at almost $50 million. Very good reviews, better than I would give it. People are even talking Oscar for it. And it's definitely building on the success of Gone, Baby, Gone, and Ben Affleck's probably going to have his choice of scripts for his next project.
Well, another film that's doing well, Resident Evil Afterlife. This is the fourth film or fifth film. I don't even know how many films they have in this series already, but it's already made $52 million here in the United States and $151 million overseas in the international territories. It's doing really, really well.
And that's why there will be a Resident Evil after Afterlife.
And Inception is just doing gangbusters. I mean, $483 million internationally and $287 million domestically in the United States. I mean, do you think it has legs enough to cross the $300 million mark?
Well, if they release it again come Oscar time, it might. It'll probably come out on DVD before then. But, you know, it could, because it could get Oscar nominations and people might want to check it out in the theater again. I've only seen it once. I want to see it a second time. But it is down to just, you know, $1.2 million a week on the weekend, so it's pretty low.
Well, now let me ask you something, Karen. You didn't get to see Wall Street Money Never Sleeps. Michael and I saw it in Cannes, but you didn't get to see it this weekend when it opened.
I have no desire to see that movie.
Okay, well then...
I wanted to see Easy A, I just didn't get around to it.
So do I.
Well, now let me ask you this. Easy A, this is a kind of a high school comedy, correct?
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, now what if you could watch that film, say, this week? It's been out for 2 weeks. So this week, at home, via video on demand, would you do it?
For $30.
Okay, no. That was the point. You weren't supposed to say that.
Oh, sorry.
If it was free, yes. For $30, no. For $15, no.
Okay, well, so we just established a bit of a kind of a price level there.
Yeah, I wouldn't pay anything more than I would if I was going to the movies and paying for the movie and parking.
Okay, well, which is around $20, don't you think?
Where do you go to the movies?
In Los Angeles?
I go to Century City. I spend 10, 12 bucks on the movie ticket and $3 to park.
Okay, well, you know, in New York, of course, it's much more. It's close.
No, it's not. You don't pay to park. You take the subway.
You walk.
Well, I mean, the movie tickets are much more, especially if it's a 3D film.
I think we're destroying the segue. Michael, do you think we're destroying the segue?
I do. Tell us about this New York Times article, Sperling.
Okay, well, you know, before, just to destroy the segue even further, when I was in Norway last week, I found out that a film costs about 100 kroner to go see.
Which is?
And that it's 6 kroner to the dollar.
Wow.
Yeah. The UK does the same thing. Their movie prices are insane. They're like 12, 15 pounds to see a movie in the UK, which means it's like $25. It's unbelievable, which is why there's so much room for growth. There aren't enough screens around the world, and ticket prices are exorbitantly high. So I think there's a huge room for growth in film theatrical overseas.
Well, don't tell that to the studios, because that's what this story is about, that we were trying, or at least I was trying to gently segue into, and as Karen pointed out very nicely, I guess I botched it. But you probably remember in the past on previous episodes, we've talked about theatrical windows, that studios release films in movie theaters first, and generally it's about 120 days later that they get released on DVD. And of course, there's been this pushback against releasing them on DVD and video on demand at the same time, so that cable companies couldn't release them when the DVD first came out. But now, as we talked about a couple of episodes back, the FCC in May, after 2 years of pushing from Hollywood studios, the Federal Communications Commission agreed to let movie studios activate a technology known as selective output control, which is kind of a DRM way of locking down which output from your cable box a video signal can come from.
It's just another way of fighting piracy, giving them a little more level of security so they feel like they can show a new movie that's in theater on your TV without thinking you're going to make a ton of digital copies and send it to all your friends.
Right. When it was initially pressed by the MPAA and studios, everybody said, oh, well, this is just because the studios want to make sure that people aren't pirating video on demand movies. But NATO, the National Association of Theater Owners, said, no. The studios want to release movies day and date with the theatrical release on what is called premium VOD, premium video on demand. And the industry wants to do this, of course, to bolster sagging DVD sales.
Well, that was in May. Why is this a news story today?
Because they're finally getting around to announcing their plans to release these films on premium VOD for $25 about.
And but if about 45 days after they open in theaters, they're going to charge you $25 to see the movie at home.
Yeah, what is that about?
Well, because they're saying, well, look, you know, we don't destroy the theatrical window if the price of watching it at home is exorbitantly high because then people will still go and watch the film at a movie theater. I would have to agree with that. I think most people still would, at $30, still go and see the film on a big screen.
It's just another window added to that long chain of, you know, theatrical and DVD and cable and satellite TV and streaming and rental via Netflix or online and video on demand and pay-per-view in your hotels and now and iTunes. And now they're adding this other window where shortly after the movie comes out in the theaters, you'll be able to pay $25 to see a movie in your home. You could see Inception right now in your home for $25. I'm sure there's some market for it, but at that price level, it just seems like a weird little add-on quirk to me.
I think it depends on how many people are going to be watching it in your home, because yeah. If it's $25 to one time to buy it, then you could bring over all your friends or have your family or whatever. Then it makes sense. But just by myself or even with one other person, it doesn't seem to be making
sure. But you can do it for $5 now if you just wait for it to be on pay-per-view. You can have as many people over as you want. So it's still a lot more than people are used to paying for pay-per-view. I'm with the theater owners. They say that they're nervous about this, about studios making this stuff available. They say, yeah, DVDs aren't as big as they were 3 years ago, big surprise, but DVDs still bring in a lot of money. And look at theatrical. It's 4 decades of box office growth and 3 straight years of record-breaking box office. And they say that means you should be careful before you screw with theatrical. You know, movies sell more tickets and gross more money at the theater than they ever have before in the last 4 decades. Every decade, it gets bigger and bigger. And when you add in DVDs and TV and video on demand and rentals and sales and streaming, it's like a $50 billion pie.
Well, so, and I just want to point out, you're talking decade by decade, not year by year, because of course year by year.
Because only an idiot would look at year by year. The long-term trend, the 70s sold more tickets than the 60s and made more money. The 80s made more than the 70s. The 90s made more than the 80s, and the noughts made more than the 90s in pure ticket sales and in dollar gross. And that doesn't even take into account the fact that suddenly in the 80s and 90s, we had this explosion of DVD where studios were making an extra $10, $20 billion that never even existed before. In the 40s and 50s. It wasn't even a part of the pie. So instead of movies being a $4 billion business, it's a $50 billion business. And so when they say, oh, DVD sales are sagging, it's ridiculous. The pie that movies gross, the big amount of money they make, is bigger than ever by far.
Well, now you did mention that DVD sales have kind of flagged a bit. And I guess last year they were $9.9 billion, which is down 30% from their peak in 2004, according to Adams Media Research. And when your business is down 30%, you really do have to worry. And
no.
I realize it's $9.9 billion, but still,
No. When you increase a new product, when you sell something new, people rush in and buy a lot of it at first, and then they settle back down into a normal standard buying pattern. When VHS tapes weren't available before, suddenly it was a new business and people bought a lot. And then once they built up a library of VHS tapes, it slowed down a little bit. Then Laserdisc came out, same thing. DVDs, same thing. There's that initial flurry where you buy 10, 20, or 30 DVDs, and then you don't buy that many every month unless you're some fanatic collector. Most people just buy a couple movies a year. It settled back down to where it would be once people built up that initial library. It's a normal pattern that they could have predicted and they knew was going to happen. And it's exactly what they knew would happen. And the fact that it's not at its record peak doesn't mean DVD, it's $10 billion. That's what they make at the box office, for God's sake. It didn't even exist as an income source in the 70s or earlier. And they're making it, they're doubling their box office right there.
Yeah,
how is that bad?
Of course, the cost of making a film today costs far more than in the
It should, because movies in the 70s and 80s, the box office was $4 billion, and now it's $10 billion in the U.S. and $50 billion when you look at all the ways they have of making money all over the world, not bigger.
Well, besides boosting DVD and home video sales, studios, of course, also want to try and cut their marketing costs, and they're hoping that by releasing a film on video on demand or premium video on demand, that they'll be able to market these films once for theatrical and home video, or at least premium video on demand, because they'll reduce that window from when they've marketed the film theatrically to when they've marketed the film for home video.
Well, it makes perfect sense for art films. It doesn't make any sense to me for Spider-Man or Inception.
Well, you know, some industry executives also feel, and there's certainly some proof to this, that premium VOD could cut down on some piracy, because you'll have people not trying. Well, I would have to agree with this. People won't be trolling the internet to try and find a way to watch the film at home that came out 2 weeks ago. They can instead just pay the $25. And let me tell you, in Los Angeles, if you were to try and see a film with a date or if you brought somebody, it's going to cost you $25 anyway. So you may as well, if it's not a big action film or it's something that you could watch at home, what's the difference? You may as well pay the $25 and watch it at home with one or more people.
Well, if people are doing something and you can make it available to them legally, you should. That's always a good idea. If they want music digitally, you should make it available to them so they don't have to steal it. But movies are available via streaming and online and video on demand, maybe not the second they want it, but they are. But the people who are willing to go to pirate websites like stageview.com and go through all the rigmarole of stealing a movie's copy are not saying, well, gee, if only I could pay $25, I wouldn't bother.
The studios that will jump on this first, probably Warner Brothers, Fox, and of course, Disney. Robert Iger is over at Disney, and he said to a group of analysts on a conference call just last month, quote, "There are people who we believe would like to see movies sooner than later and would pay a premium price to do just that. We are going to become aggressive," as opposed to what? He's not been aggressive already. He says this during every time he opens his mouth, he's talking about theatrical windows.
Well, Karen, do you ever stream movies? Have you streamed a movie online rather than, you know, having a physical DVD come to your house?
I have. Yeah, I have. I tend to watch more TV online than movies. But that's the wave of the future. We're all going to have to get used to it. People are going to have to figure it out. And studios are going to have to figure out their day and date.
Well, and we're about to get into streaming with Netflix in just a second here. But before we get off this topic, of course, you know, speaking from, I guess, an insider perspective here, John Fithian, who is the head of NATO, the National Association for Theater Owners, I've heard him speak several times. I've talked to him several times. And he basically said, look, the DVD window is going to shrink for certain titles, and theater owners are going to have to be aware of that. So for
what certain titles do you, like, what do you mean?
Like
exactly?
Big movies or little movies? It's 12 weeks. How much more can it shrink?
Well, I think that what he was saying was, and he said this numerous times, is that for certain titles that the studios come to the theater owners with and say, look, we really want to release this on DVD. Instead of in 4 months, we want to release it in 3 months. That for certain titles like, say, Alice in Wonderland, which is what they did earlier this year, they had a three-month window for that, not a four-month window, that they will do that for certain movies that both the theater owners and the studios work on together, and they pick those titles together in certain instances. But with this $25 or $30 premium VOD, experiment is just a way to get to day and date release for not $25, but more like $15 or $10. It's just a nice little baby step into this world that's not meant to upset theater owners. And I think it took, I don't want to say it took NATO by surprise because they kind of knew it was coming, but it certainly has, they were hoping that they could work more hand in hand than what is happening right now.
And what this means to the average Joe is that soon enough, you're going to have even one more option of, you know, sitting at home and watching a movie pretty soon after it comes out.
God,
you
know, we're never going to leave our houses.
Exactly.
But now let me ask you something, Karen. Do you have a Netflix account?
Of course. I've had Netflix account for years.
And Michael, I'm pretty sure you have a Netflix account.
I do not. I get so many DVDs to review. I don't have the need.
Oh, my.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
Well, I'm just saying I get, you know, tons of DVDs piled up. I have no room for them all.
Really? Let me give you my address because you can just ship some of them over my way. Actually, okay, so this was my segue into another story of last week, something that the LA Times reported and then we kind of commented on a few episodes ago. Blockbuster filed for bankruptcy, finally. And Netflix shares soared. Of course, Netflix, for those of you outside the country who don't know, and believe it or not, I found out over the past 3 weeks, there are people who don't know what Netflix is. It is a DVD by mail rental subscription service in the United States
and Canada
Canada now, but we're going to get to that in a moment. And actually, in Canada, it is not DVD by mail; it is streaming.
It is streaming only.
That is right. Yes.
And why? Because why does it cost more in the United States? Because people are so self-absorbed, they'll never know the difference.
Reed Hastings, the CEO of Netflix, said that, and he immediately backtracked, saying, "What I mean by that is, I'm
sorry. That was a joke. Yeah.
But you know, the reality is that shipping DVDs by mail, it's a hard business. Yet they have like something like 50 some odd facilities throughout the United States.
I mean, they're essentially keeping the U.S. Post Office alive.
$700 million per year in postage fees.
I'm gonna lose my mailman.
Is there something you need to tell us about your mailman?
Well, no, but you know, the post office as it is having problems, you know, because of email. You know, that everyone's doing everything online these days, that, you know, once Netflix starts, not that I really think Netflix has that big a control of the US post office, but once Netflix goes all streaming, it certainly doesn't help post office.
Well, yeah, I mean, certainly Netflix has been the DVD by mail king. They pretty much put Blockbuster out of business. They definitely put Hollywood Video out of business. And now they've moved into streaming films and TV shows. And you can watch these movies or shows on your computer or on over 100 different boxes, be it PlayStation or Xbox or TiVo or Roku. And Netflix has said that as of June 30th, 61% of their 15 million subscribers have streamed movies to one of these boxes, which is up from December of 2008 when only 15% of their subscriber base had done so.
Their advantage in DVD rentals and shipping them by mail doesn't give them any big advantage here. They don't have a lot of deals in place yet. They only have about 20,000 titles for streaming, which is very little. And their competitors can step in really easily. They don't have to build distribution centers around the country. Apple and Amazon and Google can compete right away and very heavily. And so that advantage Netflix had over Blockbuster and Hollywood Video, that's they're back at square one when it comes to streaming.
And don't think that some of the cable providers won't be jumping in trying to create their own services for their subscribers, because they have to start differentiating themselves in some way. Otherwise, they just become bit pushers.
Is that your word of the day, differentiating?
And bit pushers? What the hell is a bit pusher?
Well, bit pusher is, I mean, think about it. Yeah, broadband. Oh. I mean, that's all these, I mean, effectively, if you've got Hulu and you've got all of these online TV services for Apple TV and Google TV, why do you need cable? You might need cable because they have premium content. And you mentioned 20,000 titles, Michael. Most of those are back catalog titles, not new releases.
Yeah, that really sucks. They never seem to have the movies that I want to watch.
Now, Karen, do you watch streaming rather than video or DVD by mail?
I usually watch the movies by mail, but I'm starting to watch more and more TV shows online, and not necessarily through Netflix, by the way, either. I'm a big believer in Hulu.
Okay. All right. Well, so there you go. So there's a threat to Netflix right there.
Yeah.
And, of course, some of these studio deals require that Netflix delay the availability of certain titles, new releases, either on DVD or online, until after they've been in stores for 28 days. Now, we've talked about this previously, but still, Netflix subscribers say, we don't care that you're waiting, that we have to wait 28 days. A, we're not going to buy the DVD anyway, and B, we don't care that we have to wait 28 days. So,
and that's fine for them as long as Apple and Amazon and Google have to play by the same rules. The only the positive thing I'll say about Netflix is that, unlike Blockbuster, which looked at DVD rentals and sales and did nothing for years, unlike Hollywood Video, they recognize that they need to move into this area aggressively, and they're doing everything they can to do so.
Yes, that is true. They have definitely, I mean, Reed Hastings has said the day of the DVD is going to end for us, and he put it about 5 years out. Credit Suisse predicts that the DVD business will peak for Netflix around 2012 and then slowly decline. They're going to begin closing some of their fulfillment facilities. You know, it's the rest is history. Now, Karen, you mentioned that Netflix moved into Canada, but they aren't moving into Canada with DVDs. They're moving into Canada.
Yeah, only streaming. That's really interesting.
Right, and it's like a $9 subscription. So all of these subscription services, again, they're trading
It's like $7.99 and $8.99 here. That's where he got himself in trouble. And people asked him, you know, why the price difference? And instead of just saying, oh, because we're only streaming, we're not doing DVDs in Canada, he made that joke about Americans. I'm just like, that's the dumbest thing you could possibly do. Your mic is on. You know that, right, guys?
I think he figured it out pretty quick, because they were quick to apologize, that's for sure.
It's like, you just know that everybody who works at Netflix is like slapping their foreheads.
Right. YouTube is moving into this space as well. So, you know, now they're saying, hey, you know what? a lot of U.S. customers have said, look, I don't want the DVDs anymore. All I want is a streaming-only subscription. And of course, Netflix doesn't want to offer that because those subscriptions cost less and they make less money. However, Reed Hastings, the CEO, in a blog post on Netflix said, yeah, we're looking into it. We probably will be doing that shortly. Does that mean, Michael, you would subscribe?
I have no need. I have far more DVDs than I can handle. I have a backlog of about 1,000 DVDs to watch.
I hate you.
I'm sorry. It's one of the pleasures of being a DVD reviewer and book critic. I've got like 1,000 books, 1,000 DVDs. You know, I've got an endless supply of stuff I need to catch up on.
Well, certainly, I know we spent a lot of time on these first two stories. We should probably move on. But what I found interesting about this story is that Netflix is gaining subscribers at a rate of 50% a year. That's a pretty good business. But now, at the outset of the show, Michael, you mentioned something about being on a picket line. What the heck were you talking about?
On a picket line at the Shire, because it turns out that The Hobbit, which is getting ready to film in New Zealand, even though everything is not set yet, is a non-union film. And in an unusual move, SAG and a couple other international actors guilds all released a statement saying, you cannot work on this film. Don't work on this film. It's non-union. They have targeted the movie for being non-union. Peter Jackson, the studios, responded very angrily and upset. Peter Jackson says, I'm bringing a lot of business to New Zealand. These people only represent like 10% of New Zealand actors. They're really Australian-based. They're trying to make an example out of us when we're doing all these good things to help actors. We create a fund to give residuals to actors, even if they're not union, blah, 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 blah. It's a big war of words, but it boils down to the fact that they are filming in New Zealand because it's a non-union country. And in fact, they claim they can't deal with these unions because it's against the law in New Zealand. But of course, the very reason they go to New Zealand in the first place is because they can get cheaper labor because it's a non-union market. There's a lot of back and forth, a lot of ugliness. The studio is threatening to move The Hobbit to Eastern Europe. Peter Jackson says, who will that help? But you can't help feeling like a movie like, you know, The Hobbit, which is going to be a $1 billion franchise, how they cannot afford to pay top dollar for their talent and the people, no matter what level they're at. It's a little disheartening, frankly.
Well, they're still probably going to pay top dollar. They just won't be paying into the pension and welfare funds for all of these different unions.
No, that's why you film in non-union places, because they're cheaper to film there. They're not going to pay top dollar. It costs less money to film in New Zealand than it would filming in L.A. or New York, obviously.
Well, partly
it had to do with minimums. They weren't going to guarantee certain a minimum wage. So they don't. I don't think it's necessarily that they are not going to pay top dollar. It's more like there's no guarantee that they won't pay them the lowest dollar possible.
Kind of like any other capitalist society, but go ahead.
Well, maybe you hate unions, but also it's a question of the residuals they get once the movie goes into the black, and non-union people don't have access to that. But Peter Jackson said, we're setting up a fund to let them get some money so that they can share just like they would if they were in a union. You know, it's a big, big movie, and they want to make an example out of it. And, you know, should you be able to go to New Zealand to film cheaper by using talent that's desperate for work? I don't know.
And the funny thing is, actually, I am a pro-union kind of guy, and every time, you know, I get screwed over by some employer, I'm like, I'm going to unionize this place. But, you know, I just think that I've watched way too many independent filmmakers try and make their $2 million film and then have to wind up paying $5 million because the union comes and shuts them down.
Yeah, SAG's a tough union that I don't know if I necessarily always agree with everything that they ask for.
Well, neither do the studios. I mean, look what happened during their last strike.
Oh, yeah, no, don't get me wrong. And I was on SAG's side by all means in that case. But I do know that SAG, and I haven't dealt with them directly, it's just things that I've heard, that they're a difficult union. But then yeah, I've heard the same about WGA and DGA, so.
Yeah, a lot, and some people badmouth the WGA and DGA and say they do very little for their members, et cetera, except take their cut. And I can empathize with that and empathize with an indie filmmaker. The thing here is that we're talking about a movie that is a massive tentpole franchise. Yeah. That's what sort of makes me a little more wary of being on the studio side on this one.
Well, we should probably move on because we've got a ton of news to cover. In fact, we have some late breaking news here. Michael, do you want to mention...
Well, it's all over the websites that the Oscar-nominated film editor Sally Menke, a longtime collaborator with Quentin Tarantino, was found dead. She apparently was walking her dog in Los Angeles. It's an incredibly hot last few days, like in the 110, 20, 30 degrees with the heat factor. And apparently she was, we don't know yet officially, but it seems like she was felled by the heat and died while walking her dog. The dog is okay, as some people wondered. But,
aww.
But she is, you know, she's a mate. She's worked in every Quentin Tarantino film since Reservoir Dogs. She's gotten two Oscar nominations, one for Pulp Fiction and one for Inglourious Basterds. And it's a very sad news. I will say that in the rush to get the news out, The Hollywood Reporter described her as an Oscar-winning film editor, which is not true. And Variety spelled her name two different ways. So it's just an example.
In one story?
Yeah, the headline had her name spelled one way and the story had it another. And
oh,
so
I
it's
love
just
that.
The sort of thing that happens when you're rushing the news out. But calling her Oscar-winning is not the sort of mistake you want to make in an industry paper, I don't think.
Especially since that's so easily Googled. That kind of stuff really irritates me.
Yeah, exactly. I went, really? She won? And I Googled it and knew in 2 seconds it wasn't true.
Well, if you go to YouTube, there's a nice little 3-minute clip there of people on the Inglourious Basterds set as they made their flubs or their outtakes. They would like turn back to the camera and say, "Hi, Sally," because they were. And it's actually really a very touching and very, very nice little tribute, which was put together long before she passed away. She died actually in Beechwood Canyon, where I used to live. So it's quite a sad story. Gloria Stewart also passed away, and she's the.
I couldn't. She used to be my neighbor.
Gloria Stewart?
Yeah.
Oh, really? I did not know that. She died at 101, and she's probably best known as the actress who played Rose, the older Rose, in Titanic.
Yeah, when I lived in Brentwood, I lived maybe 3 houses away from her, and she lived almost right across the street from where OJ killed his wife, allegedly. Did not kill his wife. it was a fun little part of town to be in.
He was found guilty in civil court, so we can say it. He killed her.
Okay.
Don't want him to come after me.
On that note, now I pretty much think I heard somebody opening a beer or a
can. Just me opening up my Diet Dr. Pepper. Sorry. It's hot. It's really hot.
Well, does that mean I can like crack open this bottle of Cote de Rhone?
Absolutely.
Yeah, well, now, when did this become Dignation? Anyway, we should move on to television news.
Yay, television news.
Let's get into the fall TV roundup. Michael Caron, you know about all these shows. I figured I could play the monkey. And what I mean by that is every year, the Wall Street Journal or one of these financial type media outlets has the dartboard test where they just kind of throw darts at stock picks and see who does better, the financial analyst or the dartboard.
Or the monkey.
Or the monkey. So I'm going to be the monkey. I don't know anything about any of these shows for the most part, so I'll just pick based on the fact, based on their title.
Great. So we want to run through the shows and say whether we think they'll be canceled or survive the season. Is that the idea?
Yeah. Canceled or back 9.
Yes.
All right.
We played this game last year. It was quite popular.
So much fun. You're taking notes though, right, Sperling?
I am taking notes. Okay. Sunday, there are no new shows, so we can skip that. But let's go to Monday. On CBS, we have 2 new shows, Mike and Molly and Hawaii 5-0. Which one gets canceled?
Canceled or back 9?
Starting with Mike and Molly?
Yes.
It's going to be back 9, but then it'll be canceled the season after that.
I will say back 9, but it will last for more than one season. I really like the female lead. She's from Gilmore Girls.
She's great. I love her.
I love her. And though it's sad because she sort of lost weight in the middle of Gilmore Girls, and then she gained it back again. Now she's in a show all about being fat. It's a very poor show, but I think it's a good fit with 2.5 Men.
I'm going to go with back 9 on that just because I've seen the posters and kind of went, they look like your average everyday Americans. I could see middle America loving that. What about Hawaii 5-0?
Back 9.
Back 9. I'm not so sure about it long term, but it's because
I
love
like it.
No, it's not a good show, though Scott Kahn had sort of a nice little, you know, a little
he's
sense
great.
Of
he's great
personality.
It. Saves but the whole show.
But I love Castle, which is another, it's a really tough time slot. You've got Castle, Hawaii 5-0, and Chase, 3 very similar light cop shows that are all chasing the same audience. And Castle is still growing and in love, length, and Philly on it. And I feel like that one is the best fit.
Lone Star on Fox, back 9 or canceled?
Canceled.
Canceled.
Canceled by the time this podcast goes up.
Okay, so everybody says
I feel
canceled.
It's two episodes in. It's been a disaster. I feel sorry for the producer. He actually pleaded online for people, hey, don't give up on the show. But, you know, I've even told people, they said, oh, should I check it out? I said, no, don't bother. It's very hard if you don't get that initial momentum to keep
it's
going.
It's a really popular script and pilot season. It surprises me, but from what I hear, it was just a dog.
The funny thing is, for me, I said canceled. I have no idea what it is. I was just like, Lone Star? I don't know. Okay, now we're switching to NBC on Monday nights, The Event. I'm going to go with Back 9 on that just because the title just seems good.
I'm going to give it a Back 9, but then it will be canceled.
I'm going to give it a Back 9, too, just because NBC is so desperate they can't afford to walk away from it, but it's not going to it's a disaster.
What about Chase, which is the other show on Monday night? That
will be canceled by the time this podcast goes up.
Wow.
That's pretty generic, too. I haven't seen the numbers, but I would say it's not going to last.
I had canceled for that, too, just because I was like, I have no idea what that's about. It's either about a bank or it's about a car chase. I can't figure out what it's about.
It's Bruckheimer. It's got a really interesting lead whose name I can't remember, and she's like a U.S. Marshal or something.
Right,
and
they run around chasing people.
Badly done, from what I understand.
If I'd known it was Bruckheimer, I might have said Back 9 on that. But moving to Tuesday, No Ordinary Family and Detroit. For No Ordinary Family, I have Back 9, and for Detroit, I guess it's Detroit
187.
Detroit 187. I have...
Gotta get that homicide in there.
I have canceled for that, so I have Back 9 and canceled.
I'm going to go with Back 9 and... Detroit 187 is a tough one. Maybe, I'm going to go with Back 9, but then it'll probably...
I think... No Ordinary Family will last, though we haven't seen it yet. It debuts tonight as far as in the world outside the podcast, but it's opposite Glee, which is definitely going for sort of the same audience. And then it's got American Idol in the midseason. So that's a very tough time slot, but it's a big, big push for ABC. Detroit 187 is very generic, but it's a little alone at 10 p.m. So it should last the season.
Okay, Back 9 for both. Also on Tuesday, Glee is on a new day, but we know that's going to be picked up. Raising Hope and Running Wild are both on Fox.
Back 9 for Raising Hope, canceled for Running Wild.
Ditto. Running Wild is god-awful. Raising Hope I really quite like. It's a nice white trash show. Cute. From the guy who brought us My Name is Earl, and I hope it lasts and they move it somewhere else.
The funny thing is I had the same thing. I was like, well, Raising Hope, I kind of think I've heard of, so Back 9 on that. And Running Wild, I was like, I have no idea what that's about. Cancel it.
I cannot believe you're not obsessed with TV the way we are. I just can't understand it.
On Wednesday, some new shows on ABC, Better With You and The Whole Truth. I had canceled for both.
I'm going to say Back 9 for both.
I'm going to say Back 9 for Better With You and canceled for The Whole Truth, which is a disaster.
I liked The Whole Truth. No, that's a good show.
It did, but the numbers are bad. The numbers are bad. And Better With You is part of a great sitcom block. It's the best sitcom block, I think, in prime time. The Middle, Better With You, Modern Family, Cougar Town, they all fit together. They work together. It's sort of like that NBC Thursday sitcom flow they used to have in the 80s. It just, they're all work really well together. And I hope, and my favorite part is Cougar Town. Their title credits said still. Cougar Town because people were talking about a name change for the show. That was my favorite moment of the fall season so far.
Yeah.
The Defenders on CBS Wednesday night, Back 9 or canceled?
Canceled. That looks so awful.
Well, it is awful, though. I think Jerry O'Connell and Jim Belushi have good chemistry. It's okay. It's a very generic show. However, it's also up against Law & Order Los Angeles, and assuming that's really good, it'll be in trouble. It fits well with Survivor and Criminal Minds, but yeah.
Just don't know who the audience is for that show.
Yeah, and they're going to be watching Lola. So yeah, I guess I will say canceled as well.
I had canceled just because I was like, The Defenders sounds like a legal show that's going to lose. So I had canceled. If I had known Jim Belushi was in it, I would have had to, you know, I would have felt very confident in that pick.
He just had a big hit, according to Jim, a long-running sitcom. Thank you very much.
That was a joke for the entire time it was on.
And now one on this podcast. Hellcats on the CW Wednesday night. Back 9 or canceled? I'm going with Back 9 only because can they afford to cancel anything?
I'm going with Back 9 for that reason and because it seems to be getting good buzz in terms of the people who watch it, even though all the reviews have been awful.
Michael?
Well, just to be contrary, I'll say canceled. But you're right, the CW... I don't know if they can afford to cancel, but I don't see how long they can survive. Their biggest shows have like 2 million viewers. How long can they actually maintain that 10, 14 hours that they have of prime time with such miserably watched shows? They just literally have no hits.
Well, and then we move to NBC, where we have two different shows on Wednesday, Undercovers and Law & Order Los Angeles. I have Back 9 for both.
Undercovers canceled, Law & Order Back 9.
Law & Order, definitely Back 9. Did you watch Undercovers, Karen?
I could not bring myself because I couldn't stand the previews.
But you know, it's a really fascinating show because I think it was cast completely colorblind. The two leads are black actors, Gugu Mbatha-Raw, who is the female lead. She's beautiful. And Boris Kodjoe, who's very handsome. They're really great together. It has sort of a heart-to-heart feel. It's not a good show. Like, none of the new shows are really good. Let's get that out of the way. But
yeah.
I'm watching the show and I'm going, you know what? I don't think this was created for two black actors. And I think they really, because I didn't know that, but it just felt like it wasn't designed for that, and they were just cast because they had great chemistry, and they're really appealing, and it's a really, just on that level, it's very interesting. They're CIA agents turned gourmet chefs, you know, but so it's a nutty show, but
it's J.J. Abrams, so that bodes well for it. It was Boris Kodjoe, I believe, was cast first, and I find him, he's very handsome, but I find him incredibly uninteresting. They, from what I recall, had a real tough time casting the female lead. And they found this woman whose name I could never pronounce. And yeah, they happen to have really good chemistry. I don't think they said, we're going to look for a black woman or we're going to look for a white woman. I think they cast based on chemistry, but I find them both just exceedingly boring in all of the promos. I find the show incredibly uninteresting just from the sound of it.
I'm going to say it lasts the season. NBC is too desperate. They have nothing.
Yeah, you're probably right.
Back nine for both. Okay, let's move to Thursday night then. My Generation on ABC.
Dead.
Canceled.
It's already canceled?
Basically. It will be.
It'll be canceled by the time the podcast goes up.
Oh, man, I had back nine for that. Okay, The Big Bang Theory on a New Night, we all know that's sticking around. Bleep, My Dad Says on CBS, I have back nine.
I'm going to say canceled.
Ooh, you're crazy. Back nine and multiple seasons.
Wait, this game is called Canceled or Back Nine, not canceled back nine or multiple seasons.
Maybe we should change that, though.
I thought it was a good... I mean, the sitcoms are generally better than the dramas this season. It's not saying much, but I found Better With You and Bleep My Dad Says and Outsource to be relatively painless. And I think it's a good fit with Big Bang, and I think it's just going to work.
What about Nikita on the CW? I have back nine.
Back nine.
Oh, God, it's bad. Boy, I have to. You're right. Back nine. Like, they can't.
But people
only
love it. I thought it was bad too, but people love it. I'm like, this. I thought it was crap.
Oh, it was terrible.
Outsourced on NBC. I have back nine.
I haven't seen this. I think it sounds really, really funny, but I just have a feeling they're gonna cancel it.
Back nine. It's got to. As far as I can tell, it's the first U.S. sitcom set in a different country. I mean, it's set in India, which is really interesting. Most of the cast is Indian, and it's fairly sweet and nice, and it fits well with The Office.
Well, then let's move to Friday, some new shows. Body of Proof, which is a Dana Delaney medical drama in October. Canceled. The only reason I know any of this is because it's in the show notes. It's on ABC. I have canceled as well. So what about you, Michael?
Well, I mean, Friday is just a black hole. I mean, networks are abandoning. They abandoned Saturday, and now they're abandoning Friday. The ABC is barely even showing anything for the first 2 months of the season. Same thing with Fox. They can't be bothered to put anything on. It's just, it's unbelievable how they just ignore an entire night of television. This is completely sight unseen. It doesn't debut until October 22nd. It's Dana Delaney. It doesn't really fit between Secret Millionaire and 2020, and it's facing CSI New York. Canceled.
Okay, then let's move on to Blue Bloods on CBS with Tom.
Canceled.
Okay.
Back nine. Back nine. Back
oh
nine.
Oh, my God. I couldn't get through 10 minutes of that. I thought it was awful.
Oh, it's a terrible show. It's a great idea. It's a perfectly good idea. An intergenerational story about cops in New York City, ranging from the chief of police down to a new rookie. And it's got good cast, good actors. But then what do? They've got a perfectly good setup for a sexy show about cops, a new way of looking at them through the prism of a family of cops. And what do? They throw in this elaborate backstory conspiracy about the Templar Blues or something, the secret society of cops, and they've killed the brother. And I mean, oh, it literally gave me a headache.
Who's the audience for that show?
It fits right in with Medium, CSI New York, and Blue Bloods. It has no competition whatsoever. It's Tom Selleck. It'll last a season, and hopefully they'll straighten out their ridiculous backstory and just make it a straightforward soap.
Outlaw on NBC.
Oh, my God. Canceled, canceled, canceled. It's such a joke.
It's such a bad show. The Jimmy Smith show about a Supreme Court justice who decides to go back into law and leaves the court. The second episode begins with him making out with a chick in a hot tub. And then he finds out about his story. I mean, it was just embarrassing.
Awful. Like, what in the hell?
Yeah, it was truly embarrassing. He's the hottest Supreme Court justice ever, but still an embarrassing show.
I had back nine for that, darn it. Okay, well, that kind of wraps it up because Saturday there are no new shows.
It is, but you know what network? Two networks are in huge trouble. One is, of course, the CW. They have literally no shows. I mean, how can they continue with 3 million viewers for their best show? The other one is NBC. Except for Sunday Night Football and the preview show, they didn't have any show in the top 20 or maybe even the top 30 last year. Their highest rated sitcom is The Office at like number 52. Their highest rated drama is at like number 48. They have, you know, a reality shows in the 40s. And I mean, they literally are just off the chart. They don't even exist in prime time.
Well, I know we're going to be talking about NBC during Inside Baseball quite a bit. So why don't we save that for the Inside Baseball and just jump right into music news. Michael, you, I guess it's late breaking news that the nominees, I guess I said inductees at the head of the show, the nominees for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame for 2011 have been announced.
This is the short list of people who can be nominated into the Hall of Fame based on the people that vote. They are Alice Cooper, Beastie Boys, Bon Jovi, Chick, Neil Diamond, Donovan, Dr. John, The J. Geils Band, LL Cool J, Darlene Love, who she and Neil Diamond haven't even been on the list and they deserve to have been years ago, Laura Nyro, Donna Summer, Joe Tex, Tom Waits, who should have been in a decade ago,
wow,
and Chuck Willis. So the question is, who should get in first on this list and who doesn't deserve to be in the Hall of Fame?
I think that I love Tom Waits. I'd go with Tom Waits, Neil Diamond, Bon Jovi, Beastie Boys, Alice Cooper. Of course, Dr. John is great too, so.
Who doesn't deserve to get in?
Chic? Are you kidding me? I don't know. Who the hell is that?
That's a classic 70s R&B group led by Nile Rodgers. They have lots of hits, you know.
I don't know if I would say Donovan. I mean, wasn't he just kind of a pop star?
No, a folk singer.
Yeah, folk singer, pop star.
Who's Dr. John?
Dr. John is a big R&B jazz figure.
I don't know who any of these people are. I suck at music.
Okay. I don't think Bon Jovi belongs. I think they're just a big selling band, but they're not an important band by any stretch of the imagination. I think Neil Diamond is way overdue. Darlene Love is a legend. She was on a lot of Phil Spector tracks in the classic Phil Spector wall of sound. She's one of the really important figures. But Neil Diamond and the Beastie Boys and Tom Waits are absolutely right in there. I don't think Laura Nyro is important enough either. But, you know, you can make the Hall of Fame just a popularity contest and just throw in everybody. To me, you should have to meet a certain standard. And Donovan
LL
and Laura.
Cool J? What in the hell? Really?
Wait a second. I can't believe you don't want Bon Jovi in. I mean, you don't think Bon Jovi should be there. I mean, after that first album, Slippery When Wet, they were halfway there.
That was in their first album?
I know that, but God, I can't even get my joke out. Oh, never mind.
sorry. They're a huge act. They're a big name, but they're just not important. I mean, they got a couple hit singles, but artistically, I don't think
couple,
of them as
a couple.
I don't think of them as important artistically at all.
Hey, man, let me tell you, that band is wanted, dead or alive.
So I think it's long overdue that Tom Waits get in the Hall of Fame, and it'll be a big deal when he finally makes it in.
Well, I guess what you're saying, Michael, is that we should skip the theater news, which I talked about at the head of the show, and jump right into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our popular weekly segment where we discuss the week's top entertainment news stories and whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. Our first story is about Katy Perry's cleavage, which is ready for prime time. It's just not ready for preschool. That was the feeling of some parents who checked out a YouTube clip of Katy duetting with Elmo. While many enjoyed it, some parents were very vocal that her dress was too revealing and it didn't feel appropriate for Sesame Street. While the show is envelope-pushing in its casting and tone of diversity and acceptance, it's not interested in raising a ruckus outside of its mission of education and decided not to air the clip. Karen, are Katy Perry's boobies a big deal or a big whoop?
Is this whole debacle a big deal or a big whoop? Big deal only because of what a big whoop it really should have been. Who cares? What, are the kids not go to the beach?
Michael.
Good point. I say it's a big whoop as well because people can see it online. And she got more work. She's on The Simpsons in the next season where she'll be appearing with a live action segment of The Simpsons where she interacts with puppet versions of The Simpson characters. And she sings the 39 Days of Christmas with Homer and his family and also plays the girlfriend of Moe the bartender. So Katy Perry will survive.
Awesome.
Well, two things. One, she'll finally get to act with puppets in the end anyway. And two, They darn well better do that live action. I mean, would you want to see an animated Katy Perry or Katy Perry?
Neither, thanks.
Well, Katy Perry may not have hung out with kindergartners, but Gwyneth Paltrow is ready to hang out with some high schoolers. She's joining Britney Spears and Javier Bardem as a guest star on the Fox comedy Glee. Paltrow will be playing a substitute teacher for Mr. Schuster, and yes, she will be singing. That's no surprise to fans who remember that Paltrow had a worldwide smash hit, Cruisin', a duet with Huey Lewis that went to number one on the U.S. Adult Contemporary chart, as well as number one in Australia and New Zealand, something her husband in Coldplay still hasn't accomplished. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal, just more an example of what a massive success Glee has become.
Karen.
Well, I agree with that, but personally, I'd rather see Huey Lewis.
Wow. Actually, I love Huey Lewis, so, you know.
I love Huey Lewis.
It's hip to be square.
Well, with movie stars singing on TV, it's only fair that pop stars start acting. That's the plan for Green Day's Billy Joe Armstrong, who will jump into the key role of drug dealer St. James in his Broadway show American Idiot for 1 week. He appears on The Great White Way now through October 3rd. The show could use a little star power. It's grossing about $480,000 per week, only 36% of its $1.3 million potential. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
That's a big deal. Good for him.
Michael?
It's a big whoop.
What?
You know. Guy who composed a concept album that turned into a Broadway show pops into the show for a week. If he had joined the cast for like 6 months, then it would be a big deal.
Okay, man gets job. You're right.
Right. But if he had joined the cast for 6 months, then it would have been a big deal.
Yeah, I suppose you're right.
Well, what a crazy coincidence. Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg donated $100 million to the Newark school system just when a movie depicting him as a jerk debuts in theaters to rave reviews. Plus, he gets to be on Oprah to crow about it. That's some expensive damage control. What's he going to spend when the movie gets a ton of Oscar nominations? $200 million on anti-malaria tents for Africa? Zuckerberg angrily defended himself from charges he was cynically hoping to protect his image and said, "Movie? What movie? The Social Network? Never heard of it." Michael, is this sudden love for schools a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal because it raises the ante on what you have to do to sort of change the topic of conversation when you're getting bad press.
Karen?
I agree, but for that same reason, I think it's sort of a big whoop because this is kind of, you know, par for the course, right?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and I guess you guys didn't agree on that. I guess I'm going to just update my Facebook status here and say that you guys didn't agree. Hold on a second. First, Kevin Eubanks, and now Max Weinberg. Jay Leno is losing Kevin Eubanks, and now, just weeks before Conan launches his TBS talk show on November 8th, they make it official that Max Weinberg, longtime drummer for Bruce Springsteen, aka The Boss, is walking away from the show. Guitarist Jimmy Vivano will be replacing him. Quick, Dave, make sure Paul Schaefer is happy. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop? Never mind. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal. The chemistry between the host and the band matters a lot, and hopefully Jimmy Vivino will do a good job. I'm sure they'll survive.
I find it really hard to follow all of those names, people leaving and coming and going, and I was just like, what? Huh?
Well, wait till we get to Inside Baseball.
Well, speaking of which, Inside Baseball, our weekly segment where we discuss only the stories that Hollywood might care about. Well, this week, we have a kind of a whopper of a news story, and I should say news stories, because we have a ton of executive shuffles at Disney, at CNN. We have Jeff Zucker leaving NBC. Warner Brothers is completely a mess. Michael, I'm just going to turn it over to you for Warner Brothers, because why don't you, we're going to kind of take Jeff Zucker last, I suppose, but fill us in on some of this stuff.
Okay, well, at CNN, Jonathan Klein was the head of that network, and he is out. And he's being replaced by Ken Jouts, who was at Headline News and is the guy that brought us Glenn Beck, which in my case means he should have been fired. But anyway, so Jonathan Klein is out just as they're launching their brand new prime time with one show featuring Elliot Spitzer and another show featuring Piers Morgan. So it's one of those examples where this guy sets everything in place and then he gets booted, and it could become a big success, and then he won't be able to enjoy it. So It's kind of a strange time to do that, since they've just revamped everything and nobody knows if it works out yet. If it works out, great. Jonathan Klein deserves the success for it. But Ken Jouts is the new head at CNN. They're in third place behind Fox and MSNBC, and they're in terrible, terrible shape. At Disney, they fired the head of their online unit. Steve Wadsworth is the head of their internet division. Disney's always had a really poor presence online. All their websites, all their things, they're just not well integrated. They don't do well. They don't have a good presence. I don't know people who think that they're well done. So it's really no surprise. And Disney really should and needs a much better presence online.
Do you think that's why he left? Because I, from what I understand, it was a big surprise.
Well, I don't necessarily know that it was a big surprise. I don't know Steve Wadsworth personally. I do know several people who work for Disney Interactive. They were all either A, unhappy, or B, left.
Yeah, same here.
Yeah, so. And then the next thing is Warner Brothers. They've just, in my opinion, created a recipe for disaster. Their Barry M. Myers, the chairman of Warner Brothers, through 2013. But at the second level, they're having a troika of people all working together. Robinov, Bruce Rosenblum, and Kevin Tsujihara. And so Kevin is in charge of home entertainment. Bruce Rosenblum is in charge of TV. Robinov is with movies, I assume.
Yes, he's the president of Warner Brothers, and it's Jeff Robinov. And he used to, Karen, as you well know, be an agent at ICM. And I recall the day that he was sitting in the CAA accounting department waiting to find out whether he would be hired by CAA or not.
No way.
Yes, I remember that, 1995.
And too bad you didn't ride his coattails to now. But I think just having three people in that second tier level all fighting for responsibility and importance is just a bad idea. It rarely works well, and it's just not a good thing. Alan Horn, of course, has been a longtime fixture at the head of Warner Brothers, and he's going to be segueing out come April. And then you're going to have these three all, none of them with real power, all of them fighting for attention and authority.
Right. And I mean, certainly the only time I've known a troika to work is at Google, frankly. You have Eric Schmidt, you have Sergey Brin, and Larry Page, and everybody wondered how that would work, and so far it's been okay. They're doing all right, but they haven't had any real hardships either, so.
And yeah, really, they're just counting the money. And that brings us to NBC. Tell us, Sperling.
I was hoping you wouldn't make me go into this, but of course, Jeff Zucker, who started out on the Today Show, or he didn't start out there, but he wound up creating a better Today Show. He is leaving. He is the chief executive of NBC Universal, and he told the company's employees in an email last Friday morning that he would step down from his position atop that studio upon the completion of the takeover of NBC by Comcast. Now, Comcast being the cable provider, one of the country's largest cable providers, at least in the U.S., Zucker was the longest serving senior manager at NBC. He worked for NBC for 24 and a half years. And I guess this was just kind of, everybody knew this was coming, don't you think?
Oh yeah, I don't think this was a surprise at all. And from what I understand from people who work there and from just reading about it, it was long overdue as well. I mean, people seem to be amazed that he had stuck around as long as he did. He didn't shepherd any hits. He didn't even seem to be all that into television programming. He was much more interested in being a CEO and, you know, sliding in reality programs where he could, you know, save a buck.
Yeah, no, and his argument that he makes is that NBC Universal is a much bigger pie and that he's had a lot of success in all the areas outside of prime time. All we look at are the movies. We don't focus on the theme parks. We don't focus on all the other areas where they make money. And Jeff Zucker says, look, I did a great job in cable. We've got USA, Bravo, Sci-Fi, Oxygen. They've all posted profitable years for like 5 years in a row now. You know, they keep, you know, setting records for what their channels are. He says he's done a lot in other areas of the company. He said the only area I haven't done well is that whole prime time thing.
Yeah, well, they went from first to basically, I don't want to say last, but they're certainly not doing well. And, you know, he took over Seinfeld. Was Seinfeld still on the air when he took over? I don't think so. But
no,
they were still doing much better than they are today. They were in first place, and now they're in third if they're lucky.
Yeah, he just drove NBC into the ground.
No, they're not in third. They're in fourth. I mean, they're behind ABC, CBS, and Fox. Absolutely. They're in fourth place. They're barely ahead of CW.
So then you see him, you've just proved my point even more so.
And I think what really irked people who worked there was that he just didn't take responsibility for anything that went wrong, and he would take responsibility for successes that weren't his. And the creative community didn't like him. I mean, it's just, when you read it all now that he's leaving, all of his minuses, it really does make you wonder, how in the hell did he stick around so long? I mean, did he have naked pictures on somebody?
No, but, you know, the heads of GE really liked him, Jeff Immelt, so much so that even after they announced that Comcast would be taking over, or that they had reached a deal for Comcast to purchase NBC Universal, the majority stake, Comcast will own 51%, GE will own 49%. Even after they announced that and were waiting and still are awaiting regulatory approval, they gave Jeff Zucker a 3-year deal, knowing that more than likely once the sale took place, that Zucker was out. So that means they have to pay off his contract.
Right. Well, you know, as far as success and failures, he's the top guy. So any success that happens, he does get credit for, because it happened on his watch. You know, the big thing he did, of course, was the Today Show, which he turned into a massive moneymaker. And, you know, the morning and late night areas make so much money for the networks. And you just can't overlook that. What a moneymaking machine the Today Show became. And it still is today, thanks in part to what he did. More importantly, I think, if the Jay Leno gamble had worked, and if NBC's 10 p.m. slot Monday through Friday with Jay Leno had paid off, and it could very easily have paid off. If that had worked, he might still be in a job, but he'd also be considered a genius, and everybody would be singing his praises. That was the biggest gamble he took, and it was the biggest flop that NBC had, and he failed in so many other ways. That one thing had worked, and it must, you know, keep him awake at nights. You know, he'd have a much better track record to point at.
Yeah, but when your biggest gamble is jumping out of a plane without a parachute, I mean, you know, you pretty much know the outcome there.
I thought it was a good gamble, but anyway.
Well, you know, a lot of his friends have said that he might move into some type of politics. And he told the New York Times, am I interested in politics? Yes. Is it something I'm going to do right away? No. But ultimately, he said, don't worry about me. I'm going to be just fine. Meaning, yeah, I just got paid 3-year salary or close to it.
Yeah. Well, and enough to keep a normal person set for the rest of their lives.
Well, and who is taking over NBC Universal? The same person who said he would not be taking over NBC Universal, the head of Comcast, or one of the heads of Comcast, Steve Burke.
Well, maybe Jeff Zucker can go volunteer at the Lincoln Center and try to help them out.
Yeah, well, and we'll see how Steve, you know, Burke is kind of an unknown in the entertainment world, certainly in the Comcast world and the cable world, he's well known. And according to Brian Roberts, the chief executive of Comcast, he called him an experienced, talented, and visionary leader with over 25 years in the media entertainment industry. So we'll see how he does. Now, another just kind of in a passing note, and I don't mean this in any derogatory way, but we are running out of time. I wanted to mention that Eugene Hernandez, who has been on this program before, is leaving IndieWire after 15 years. And I'm still shocked that he's leaving. It's his baby. He helped found it, and he edited the, I wanted to say newspaper, but it's not a trade publication.
A website.
Yeah, it's a website, and it's a phenomenal website. It's where Ann Thompson and many of our friends call home, and he's leaving, and he's headed off to the Film Society of Lincoln Center, where he will be the director of digital strategy. I'm not quite sure what that means, and as somebody who works in the digital cinema world, I'm somewhat interested and curious, but I wish him luck, and I'm sure, I mean, what do you guys think?
Well, I didn't have a great experience with IndieWire, so when I say this, it means a little more, because frankly, if you start a website and 15 years later it's still running and you're leaving, that's going to continue after you, that's a big accomplishment.
It's amazing.
Yeah,
that's amazing.
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure, you know, he pretty much laid a solid groundwork there, and I know, I guess you kind of had some, you worked for them at one point, or were freelance for them at one point, and I guess
very, very briefly.
Right. Well, rather than get into all of that, we should probably just close out the show and say that, hey, you know what? You can find links to any of the stories we've discussed in today's episode or this week's episode on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That is also where you will find ways to subscribe to our podcast, either through iTunes or the Zoom Marketplace or your favorite RSS reader. There are links to all of our social networking accounts, including Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, Delicious. I can't remember all of them. In fact, if you want to email us, you can find our email address there. It's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-SAND. 7263. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each of our episodes is by MGMT, the popular indie rock group who can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com, or on MySpace, myspace.com/MGMT. Karen Woodward can be found on her website, karenwoodwardonline.com, or on Twitter, @Karen_Woodward is the username to look up. Michael Giltz, his information is really easy. You can find him on the Huffington Post or on his website, michaelgiltz.com, or on Twitter, @MichaelGiltz is the username to look up. I'm on Twitter, @Sperling is the username to look up, or you can find some of my writing on Celluloid Junkie. Until next week, play nice.